from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you're going to dream, you might as well dream big. Tonight's guests, Anne Bancroft and Liv Arneson, did just that, and then some. In 2001, the two former school teachers became the first women to trek across Antarctica. Tonight on Point, they tell the story of their incredible journey across the southern polar cap, and we explore the guts it takes to do very difficult things. But first, we begin at the opposite side of the planet, 500 miles from the North Pole. The Ward Hunt Ice Shelf, the largest in the Arctic, has broken up. The disintegration of the 3,000-year-old shelf appears to have been caused by both a century-long warming trend and maybe a recent spike in temperatures. Andrew Revkin is a science writer for the New York Times. I asked him to describe exactly what has happened with the giant ice shelf.
In the Arctic Ocean, jutting out from the northernmost part of Canada, heading toward the North Pole, is a big shelf of ice. It's literally like a sombrero fringe that sticks out. It floats in the ocean. It's attached to the land. And it's been there for thousands of years. It's part of a much broader ice sheet that's all gone away over the last 100 years or so. This is kind of the last little, not so little, but the last 400 square kilometer hunk left. And it's, in the last 2 years, broken in pieces and starting to sort of shift around.
Has it literally fallen off the Canadian coast, or is it just that it's broken up and will eventually float away?
Well, it's sort of like a ship that's been untied from a dock but hasn't moved away yet. It's bound to move away. There is some possibility, one scientist told me yesterday, that it could refreeze, but they really see that as virtually zero probability.
And what's the size of this ice shelf?
400 square kilometers, 150 square miles, and it's about 80 to 100 feet thick. Unlike most of the ice floating in the Arctic Ocean, which is only about 10 feet thick, this is really more like the big stuff. It's not as big as some icebergs that come off of glaciers, but the pieces, once they drift away, will last for many years.
What's the speculation about exactly why this huge chunk of ice has broken up?
As far as I can tell, it's all about warming. The question is, what kind of warming? Is it human-driven through emissions from smokestacks and tailpipes, or is it part of natural cycles? And that's still very unclear. In fact, the scientists who did this report said they couldn't conclude one way or the other yet. But many of them pointed out that what happened in this event is typical of things that can happen as a world warms gradually. You get sudden changes from that gradual warming that can kick fairly dramatic phenomena into play. Essentially, in the summertime, the surface was getting up above the freezing point, and you get meltwater forming on top, ponds and pools of meltwater, and that kind of seems to percolate down through little fissures in the ice and accelerate its breakup.
In fact, there was even a lake on top of this shelf, as you describe it.
Well, there's actually a lake behind it. It acted in a weird way like a dam. Even though it's floating, over the thousands of years, there was fresh water accumulated on top of the denser salt water. 140-foot deep lake of sorts. It's a freshwater ecosystem that was there for thousands of years. And when this ice cracked up a year ago, all that freshwater poured into the ocean. So now, again, something that had been in place for thousands of years actually had unusual species that were only in that, of plankton, that kind of thing, that were only in that freshwater are now gone.
Now it's all gone, just dumped essentially into the salt water beneath the shelf.
Yeah, it was just basically a dam that broke.
When you talk with the scientists who watch this, you say they can't say exactly what's going on here yet. But are they looking at it with a kind of calm scientific calculation, or are they saying, good Lord, the Arctic's breaking up. What's going on?
There are plenty of scientists who are sort of scouring for multiple clues that might give a better hint of whether human activities are contributing. And when you look at the sort of the accumulation of evidence, that's when you start to see this significant warming in recent years is being hard to explain by other means. Actually, I flew over Ward Hunt Island in this area last spring on the way to the North Pole, where I was with a group of scientists who were studying the shifts in that floating sea ice I was talking about. And that's been shrinking and retreating every summer for many, many years. And that's another one of the signs of things in the Arctic becoming very different than the way they have been through the earlier part of the century.
It was just a year ago or so that we heard of a huge shelf breaking off of Antarctica. Related?
Conceivably, there is part of Antarctica, the big long arm of Antarctica that kind of sticks up towards South America has been warming dramatically over the last few decades, and that's where you're seeing the same phenomenon happening. But other parts of Antarctica have gotten colder. So it's a complicated world, and we haven't been able to adequately model it with computers or monitor it carefully enough yet to know what is at play here. But what we do know is that there are significant changes afoot. And the scientists and others who call for some sort of actions to slow the human contribution to greenhouse warming are saying it's sort of like hedging your bets. You don't know what horse is going to win the race. You don't know that your house is going to burn down, but you still buy insurance.
And once things begin to change, they can change very rapidly.
Well, that's one of the lessons people were taking away from this latest report in the Arctic.
Andrew Revkin, thank you very much for joining us.
No, it's my pleasure.
Andrew Revkin is a science writer for the New York Times. He spoke with me from New York. Everyone has dreams, and usually some that seem close to fantasy. To win Olympic gold, find a cure for cancer, star on Broadway, walk on the moon. But while all of us can dream, few have the moxie or mettle to make those wildest dreams come true. Anne Bancroft and Liv Arneson are among that number. In a journey that boggles the imagination, these two adventurers and former school teachers set out to conquer Antarctica. For 3 months, across 1,700 miles, facing bone-numbing temperatures and endless challenges to the mind and body, this determined duo chased their dream across the polar cap and succeeded. They became the first women to cross Antarctica on foot, and we'll talk with them tonight. Can you imagine yourself skiing past the South Pole? Do you envy those who do, or do you wonder why they do it? What drives people to attempt the seemingly impossible? What's your personal Antarctica, your oversized dream? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio are Anne Bancroft and Liv Arneson. They are the first women to trek across Antarctica and have written a book about the experience entitled No Horizon Is So Far, A Historic Journey Across Antarctica. Good evening and welcome to you both. It's great to have you with us.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
There's so much we want to know about exactly how you did this, but just to get the bios, just a bit of it out there first. Liv, you're a Norwegian. You've been an explorer for some time. It wasn't your first time on snow or ice.
No, I skied solo to the South Pole in 1994. I've been crossing Greenland, trying to climb Mount Everest, so I've been...
So a little experience in rough undertakings. And Anne Bancroft, same for you. You're a Minnesota native, but no stranger to real challenges when it comes to snow and ice and expedition.
Yeah, I got my big expedition break in 1986 when I joined 7 men and 49 male dogs to go up in, to the Arctic region and see the North Pole, and went across the ice to the South Pole in 93 with an all-women's group, went across Greenland as well with that same bunch, and got the bite.
So but it's funny you mentioned 7 men and 49 male dogs. Does that make a difference that they were male dogs?
I think so. That's why I mentioned it.
We're going to have to learn more about that. There you are. You were both school teachers at one time. It was in the autumn, in our hemisphere, northern hemisphere, of the year 2000 that you set out on this expedition across Antarctica. November, the beginning of the Antarctic summer. How old were you at the time, each of you?
I'm too old to remember.
Yeah. I was 47.
And I was 45.
So this was not, not old, but not in the first blush of youth either. I mean, I can think of a lot of 40-somethings who, you know, just getting around the track or out for a walk is a challenge. You were setting out to cross Antarctica at that age. What did your friends say? What did your family say? Oh, that's just what they do, or this is crazy, Liv?
I think more that's how they are. That's what they do. They have been living with us for so many years, and for both Anne and me, this is sort of a childhood dream. So that has been our interest for many, many years.
Childhood dream, Anne Bancroft, you've said as well. I think both of you read of the story of Ernest Shackleton in your youth, and of course his famous kind of doomed expedition to Antarctica, but one that he saved through incredible perseverance and brought through. You know, I read that, and I thought to myself, you know, some people read the story of Shackleton and say, amazing story, I never want to go there. You read it, and even as youth somehow said, amazing story, I want to go more or less to the scene of that trouble and trial and arduous test. Why?
You know, I just want to say I'm a strange kid, but, you know, sometimes it just happens spontaneously. And when I opened the pages and those remarkable photographs of that era, And it showed the men killing time playing soccer on the ice and the dog teams. And I'm a dog lover and always dreamed about doing dog sledding. I just envisioned myself in the pictures that I was seeing, you know, on the pages of that book. And from then on, it was something I yearned for.
And it came to pass that you found yourself in Antarctica. Anne Bancroft, give us the setting here. November 2000, you're preparing to do what, with what equipment, from where to where? Where in Antarctica was the part where you began near, was it nearest to South America, nearest to Africa? I can't really picture it.
Well, I'll give you the nutshell version. We left from Cape Town, South Africa. It's okay. Actually quite close to Antarctica. Mm-hmm. And we flew to a place called Blue One. It's a blue ice runway. No pavement, no airport or anything. It's just a strip of blue ice. And it's in a sector of Antarctica called Queen Maud Land, which is actually the Norwegian sector of Antarctica. Mm-hmm. From there, we'll work our way to the South Pole. From the South Pole, then we'll work our way to the other end of the continent, a little over 1,700 miles in our case, and find ourselves close to the Ross Ice Shelf, or on the Ross Ice Shelf, I should say, mm-hmm. which has an American base nearby. So, you know, one of our hopes was to sort of, you know, call attention to the fact that we're not only chasing a childhood dream, but we're from two very different parts of the world. As young girls, you know, an ocean away, we were dreaming the same thing. And here we are starting and finishing our journey with our nationality sort of, being a part of it.
From the Norwegian sector to the American sector or near the American base. And Liv, what about the equipment that you set off with? Give us a sense of how, what you were dressed in, what you were carrying. How do you even begin to go on a, 90-day nearly trek across that terrain? What did you take along?
Yeah, our goal is to have the sledges as light as possible, but it ended up with 250 pounds.
These are the sleds that you pulled yourself behind you.
Yeah, we put everything we needed was in our sleds. So the heaviest thing was the gas that we needed
for your cook stove.
For the stove. And the food, of course, the tent, one mm-hmm. sleeping bag each. And we had an extra pair of skis because we also planned to ski sail, so we had two pairs of skis.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried to have as little of spares as possible to make it as light as possible.
And Anne, the ski sailing was actually critical to your planning for getting across before the Antarctic summer ended. It was critical to the number of miles you needed to make each day. What's ski sailing? What is that?
It was incredibly critical. I mean, we chose a route that was about 2,400 miles from start to finish, and so we needed that natural resource, the wind. The ski sailing is a marvelous way to travel. We have a harness around our waist, and from our harness goes what we call a steering bar, and from the bar are all the lines that go out to the sail. And three of the four of our sails were rectangular. The fourth sail was more of a triangular sail, very large. So we had four different sizes.
And something like a parasail, when I look at the photographs. I mean, not exactly,
but
a little bit of that look, way out off your waist and then way out in front of you.
Yeah, it's supposed to be out in front. It's pulling you along.
I do.
You noticed.
And what kind of speed could you reach if you had a good wind and a smooth surface?
You really want to maintain somewhat of a lower speed. I mean, we're on our skis with our legs being the shock absorbers, and mm-hmm. it's not a flat, white environment.
So it's not a sprint, but you want to make good. How many miles on a good day of ski sailing?
Our best mileage day, which I love to talk about, it was 77 miles, which was really a charge for us. But typically, we were around 35, 40, 45 miles.
But 77 on the best day, and not every day was the best day. There were some very, very bad days. We'll hear about that when we come back. We're talking tonight with the first women in history to trek across Antarctica and what it takes to do very difficult things. What drives people to attempt the seemingly impossible? And can you imagine yourself skiing past the South Pole? Do you envy those who do, or do you wonder why they do it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the first women in history to trek across Antarctica and what it takes, talking about what it takes to do very difficult things. Imagine boots and skis and a 250-pound sled behind you and 1,700 or 2,000 miles, and not just any miles, but Antarctic miles in front of you. Are these women the kind of role models you want for your daughters, your sons, yourself? And what's your takeaway from the story of an Antarctic crossing? My guests tonight are Anne Bancroft and Liv Arneson. They are co-authors of the new book, No Horizon Is So Far, Two Women and Their Extraordinary Journey Across Antarctica, a journey that took place in late 2000 and early 2001. You can join the conversation with them. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Liv Arneson, so here you are, 250-pound sleds, skis, sails, food, gas for the cook stoves, a tent just big enough to hold the two of you and whatever you needed to pull in there to keep warm. And facing, give us a sense of the variety of terrain that you would face in this long trek across Antarctica.
Yeah, most people think Antarctica is very flat, like a
sure, you
a
just
floor.
Put on your skates and
yeah.
off you go. Or...
The terrain is really undulating. We start from sea level and climb up to close to 4,000 meters. The highest point is off to the pole, actually.
4,000 meters?
Yeah.
Did you have to climb to that? Did
not climbing. Oh, we are slowly climbing.
But you actually you went to 4,000 meters. That's, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That's mountainous.
Yeah, that's mountainous, and then you go down again to closing to the Ross Shelf. And people think it's a boring place to be, mm-hmm. but the light is changing every day.
And this was
every hour.
Entirely, or for most of the time, 24-hour light. You
24 hours light in the summertime, mm-hmm. but still the clothes make different shades. Mm-hmm. So the colors moved from gray to royal blue. And the terrain was undulating. The surface was sometimes like a frozen ocean and sometimes quite flat and blue ice and crevasses. And
All of that. And you write quite beautifully about how the sky is very much a part of your reality when you're crossing Antarctica. I spent a lot of time in the Arctic, actually, so I know that sensation. But where the horizon is literally as far away and flat as it could possibly be, and as you write, it almost feels like you're stepping into the sky. There's no house, no power line, no nothing breaking that line of sight between you and the sky in Bancroft.
It's an unencumbered view, and it's big sky country. I mean, there's just before you. It's so much sky. And I mean, there was one day that I think we saw three, maybe, storms, and they were very separate, but because it's so vast as you look out. Mm. They're all independent and doing their own thing, and yet we're in our own weather system. So you can see a great distance. The air is very clear. There's nothing to get in your sight way, and it's just the immensity of it is really... it's very hard to put words to it, but it's such a joy to be in something like that because it's very unworldly for so much of the globe. And
At the other pole, I found it, and I wasn't nearly as close to the pole as you, but even so, I found it humbling. I mean, almost in a way frightening because it is so perfectly vast, such a perfect bowl of almost nothing above and around. What about wildlife? Once you got away from the coast, is there any?
No, there really isn't. We would see snow petrels a few days in, and they'll leave us. The food sources all around the outer banks of Antarctica. We're moving into the interior, so each day that we step closer to the center of Antarctica, our chances of seeing anything in flight, particularly because a lot of the birds have quite a range. Mm-hmm. It's not until the very end that we would see penguins and seals.
And the terrain right underfoot, because of course it's a huge trip, but it's accomplished one step at a time. Liv mentioned the crevasses, that it's not smooth going. What is the variety of terrain that you're actually walking on, Liv?
It's everything from actually not deep snow, but for Antarctica, 20 centimeters is quite deep.
Mm-hmm.
And very hard snow, like rock, and blue ice, difficult different ice. And also when on the other side, on the Shackleton Glacier, mm-hmm. we actually was walking on rock. We were crossing moraines in the glacier.
So you've got skis, you've got boots, you've got crampons all the time?
Yeah. No, mostly we were on skis.
Most of the time on skis. Wow, what a picture. You couldn't carry all the food you needed for that trip the entire way. You had a food drop at the South Pole, and you would have picked that up sort of Christmas was your goal, but you missed that goal, Anne.
I think we got there, what, day 64?
16th of January.
Yeah, but what day was that on the trail? It was quite a ways into the journey.
Later than you had expected.
Much later than we had expected. So.
And already that lateness eating on your mind because you know that at the other end, a ship will be waiting to take you out and it cannot stay, it cannot risk being caught in the winter ice there.
That's exactly right. So we had this in a way, a big decision looming as we were approaching the pole about whether or not we would, in fact, be able to move on to the second half of the journey in a reasonable amount of time, and fortunately we felt we could and we're able to prevail.
We want to get into some of the challenging days on the way to doing that, but I want to invite our callers in first. You can join this conversation with Anne Bancroft and Liv Arneson, the first and only women to have trekked across the Antarctic. What's your Antarctic crossing, that nearly impossible dream, and do these stories help you imagine accomplishing that dream? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Randall's calling from Ripon, Wisconsin. Hi, Randall. You're on the air.
Hi, Anne and Liv. I guess my question was, how does this expedition with the two of you compare with other expeditions that you've had prior to this as in the way of teamwork and the like?
So you've both had a lot of expeditions, as you describe them, in both poles, Greenland, the Himalayas, some with all men, some with all women. This was two women, a small number, and no one driving alongside in a Winnebago. How did it compare to others?
Well, I think since we had this experience being on other teams, both of us wanted to do this expedition on search of finding the right, the perfect teammate.
Mm-hmm.
And Anne was the one that contacted me, and I met her first time 4 years ago. And we walked and talked, and we actually didn't talk about Antarctica or expedition at all, just getting to know each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think only after 3-4 days we found out, and I describe it like I found my sister's soul.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same values, the same interest for education, the same love for the terrain. So I would say that this time I think I found my, the perfect expedition partner.
That's great. And in terms of the terrain and the circumstances of this expedition, Anne, how did it compare with other challenges you've undertaken?
Oh, it's I think the top and the bottom of the world are worlds apart in so many ways. They have different challenges, and of course they come.
How so? You mean the Arctic and the Antarctic? So
yeah,
different.
You're going across an Arctic Ocean at the top of the mm-hmm. world. You're on a continent, a landmass covered in ice at the bottom of the world. You know, from there on, it's just many, many differences. And the other thing that happens is you meet these challenges at different times in your life. And so the equation changes slightly. I mean, I'm so, grateful that I was able to meet Liv at this stage in my career, mm-hmm. as it was. And when we look forward to the next trip that we want to do together, we look at that equation and that challenge and say, this is a good time for us to be taking it on. I'm sort of relieved that I'm no longer 30 doing these things because I have a better presence of mind doing the journeys. I might have been mm-hmm. a bit more agile mm-hmm. at 30,
mm-hmm.
But I think there's a certain internal part of me that's matured in a way that I think I appreciate these journeys in a much deeper level.
Talk to us about how that presence of mind was ultimately most tested on this trip. There were physical tests, there were emotional tests, as you both describe the trip. Give us some of the really toughest parts, physically, emotionally, Anne?
Well, I'll give you the physical one because I think Lieve can talk about the wind or lack thereof, which was our other challenge. But I injured my shoulder on day 17, and that was going to be its own little expedition that I would have to deal with.
And not a small injury.
Not a small injury, and early in the trip. I think that's the most significant piece, is that it was so early on, and it really left huge question marks as to what the fate of certainly my ability to continue on would be. And then, of course, that trickles over onto Lieve.
Mm-hmm.
So when your team is just two, you have very little leeway with something like that to flex and bend. And, you know, if there were four of us, I could leave if it got so grave, and then the three of them can continue on. But it's a bigger discussion if she was to go out on another solo venture at that point. So that would have been my physical struggle on the journey, and Lieve has our other.
Well, let's stick with that one for a moment, because, of course, when you depend on each other, it's a two-woman team here, suddenly you've got an injured shoulder. That puts everything in jeopardy, and undoubtedly puts more weight on Lieve to, I don't know, break the trail or go out front.
Exactly.
And the its ramifications went on for a long time, over many, many miles. Lieve, level with us here. What was your emotional response to that? You're supposed to, were you cursing your partner for her clumsiness and injuring her shoulder and putting more weight on you and endangering the entire expedition?
No, not at all. My only thought was how I could, I tried to put myself in Anne's shoes and how I could help her, I could help her and us together to come to reach McMurdo. So I was never angry. That could have happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
So never.
So what was your most emotionally challenging portion of the trip?
That was the weather. We planned to sail much, much more than we actually did.
And you needed to sail to make the big mileage.
We needed to sail. We needed to cover 40 kilometers a day. Pulling, you only can make about 25.
Mm-hmm.
And when we reached the South Pole, the scientists there could tell us that this was the warmest and the summer without the less wind that has been for as they started to measure this.
Oh my gosh!
And of course we knew.
God's joke for you.
Yeah. So that was because then we have this, and we had this time pressure, and it was sort of increasing increasing every day. So that was the hardest part. Will we stop at the pole or can we continue? And I was thinking about all the kids that was following us. We didn't want to disappoint them. We didn't want to disappoint the team we had in Minneapolis.
Mm.
So I think it was more about because we had all this communication with other people.
Right. A lot riding on this trip. Anne Bancroft, can you describe that? We haven't really talked about it, but this, on the one hand, there's something very low-tech about this. It's skis and legs one step after another. On the other hand, you were wired out to the world like maybe no Antarctic expedition before. What give us that, a sense of that network.
There's certainly more than we have ever experienced. We carried with us the most significant piece of technology for us, aside from the sails, was the satellite phone. And that phone about the size of a long shoe, size 9 men's, allowed for us to speak to our audience all over the globe.
And this was an audience that you had you'd prearranged for school children and others. You talked to CNN as well, but most importantly, as I read you, school kids to follow this expedition, to see what it takes and to see two women doing it.
That's right. We actually developed a curriculum, K through 8 curriculum, as well as a Dare to Dream curriculum, which really involved a lot of different ages talking about their own dreams and the steps that one should take to try and obtain them. And so that was the beginning of that audience and where our commitment lay as former teachers to try and ignite young people to their own possibilities and their own dreams, understanding that there's very few people that want to do what we're doing. That's fine, but there's the metaphor for expeditions can reach out to many, many disciplines. And our audience, of course, grew. We were getting messages from Swiss chefs, you know, and people all
over. How many kids were plugged in? How many students were plugged in?
There were over 3 million children plugged in.
To the internet site that was accompanied this?
Our voices were there every evening, mm-hmm. about a 3 or 4 minute message about our day. We would take turns doing this each night. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the following just started to grow as the word got out. And then we would get messages in, usually text messages that would allow for us to see some of the responses and hear some of the stories that were coming from people who were following it.
Of course, it's exhilarating to know the whole world is watching in a way. But when things aren't going so well, you're also sitting there as the role models on skis, and sometimes in trouble, Liv. There were moments when you just weren't sure how this was all going to turn out.
Yeah, that was we had many of those moments, how it would turn. And we had discussions, especially how we should plan our day. Should we pull 10 hours a day or should we pull 8 hours a day? So we had the energy to get up 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning to mm-hmm. sail when the wind showed up. So we had all these strategy discussions and would we make it, would we not make it, should we stop at the pole? So that was... That was from the very beginning, really.
Yeah. Even considering giving up at the pole, which was sort of halfway across. Give us some of the nitty-gritty here, Anne Bancroft. Your toes sounded awful. Purple, toenails fallen off, frostbitten, or what exactly went on with your toes?
Oh, it was. We were coming down the Shackleton Glacier, and it was very, very icy, and it forced us into our crampons for long hours each day instead of being in skis. We had no problem with boots up until that point, and the downhill slope and the biting of the metal, you know, strapped into these soft boots, I just ended up losing most of my toenails.
5,000 calories a day intake. How on earth do you do that, and why?
Well, it's very easy to do.
Well, yeah.
It's a very fatty menu, and the reason we do it is because we're working exceedingly hard. We're burning calories whether we're moving or whether we're sitting in a tent. You know, we're in this cold environment 24 hours a day, 97 days, and it's, you know, we're having no problem putting the calories in, and we're having no problem burning them, and burning not only 5,000 calories, but 45% of those calories really is fat.
You needed the fat, and you needed salt.
Yeah, we like
you ate Pringles hand over fist.
Every night we got to dig into of course they weren't in cans for the trip, they were vacuum packed,
yeah.
a whole can of Pringles as an hors d'oeuvre to warm up to dinner.
And a real fear of the sun, Liv Arneson, because of course you were under the hole in the ozone layer in Antarctica.
Yeah.
A very punishing sun, and your skin showed the effects of it.
Yeah, and most of the time we actually covered our skin with masks, but when we were pulling we couldn't do that, so we try to protect our skin as good as possible. But we work hard, and of course it's hard for our skin.
And the sun burns right there, and there's really not much atmosphere to keep it off. There they are, purple toes, 5,000 calories, sunburned, wondering whether they can make it all the way across. We're talking tonight with the first women in history to trek across Antarctica and what it takes to do very difficult things. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. What drives people to attempt the seemingly impossible? And can you imagine yourself skiing past the South Pole? Do you envy those who do or wonder why they do it? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the first women in history to trek across Antarctica, about their experience and about what it takes to do very difficult things. I'm joined in the studio by Anne Bancroft and Liv Arneson. Anne's an American from the Minneapolis area. Liv Arneson from Norway. In late 2000, they took off across Antarctica in the Antarctic summer, to become the first women to cross that continent's landmass on foot ever, about 90 days later. You can join our conversation tonight. Are these women the kind of role models you want for your daughters, your sons, yourself? And what's your personal Antarctic crossing, that nearly impossible dream. Do these stories help you imagine accomplishing that dream? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Bancroft and Liv Arneson have written up their experience of crossing the Antarctic in their new book, No Horizon Is So Far. You can join our conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Steve's calling from Maynard, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great.
Very quick question. I'm wondering if you saw any signs of pollution once you got perhaps a mile or two from the shoreline. I'm assuming it's a little bit polluted along the shoreline, or you can find things. And the second part of the question is, were you forced to leave anything behind yourself as you went through this area?
Steve, why do you ask about pollution? Do you think of the Antarctic as a polluted zone?
I'm worried about it. I've done a lot of offshore sailing, and I've been stunned when I'm 1,500 miles from the nearest land, and I'm surrounded by garbage.
In the open sea.
In the open sea. And from my point of view, perhaps Antarctica is the last place where you don't have that experience.
Yeah, disheartening at sea. But let's hear what it looked like on the Antarctic. Liv, did you see pollution out there? It's hard to imagine where it would come from, but so maybe it's the last great clean place.
No, we didn't see any pollution. It's very white, very clean, and I think Arctic is much, much worse than Antarctica.
Because of expeditions to the Arctic?
We are closer to Europe, mm-hmm. closer to the industry in Europe. Actually, we could see the polar bears. I have a lot of problems. I work a lot in the Norwegian Arctic, and there's a lot of garbage, for instance, around the island of Spitsbergen.
Now, where is that exactly?
It's
the Norwegian Arctic, you're saying.
It's north of Norway, mm-hmm. the mainland yep. of Norway. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Anne and I didn't see any pollution.
Mm. Anne, what about, you mentioned stopping off at the South Pole where there was some kind of research station. Is it there all the time?
It is. It's a year-round base. And actually,
American or international?
It's an American base.
And you had your first full meals there, real showers, the works.
We did have a shower there, and we traded a lecture for breakfast, some eggs and bacon, and it was fantastic. But, you know, I when I think of pollution, I think of when we first started approaching the South Pole, what you see is the train of coming from those C-130s. So you see the evidence, you know, in the air way off of that jet.
Just the jet exhaust.
The jet exhaust. Mm-hmm. And as we get finally even closer, we do smell. And that was the first thing that I actually remember smelling was the fuel smell, because there are vehicles there. There are very few vehicles, but there's a couple of snow machines and a few cars. And, you know, it's really an intrusive.
Of course, in that environment, again, in my experience, there's very little to smell. Any smell really stands out, and especially that kind of petroleum burnt off and diesel and all that. I can imagine jet fuel. But it sounds, Steve, as though that floating open sea garbage isn't a real issue in the Antarctic, and we're happy to hear it. Dong Li is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say that you guys did an amazing thing, and I would totally support my children having you guys as their role model, and I think it's great to have people doing these kind of things.
Thank you.
Dong Li, explain exactly why. Because they were prepared to take on such an ambitious goal, a goal so ambitious it's almost crazy, and then follow through on it, or the strength, the courage to keep going? What is it exactly?
Well, I live by the rule that life is short and you have to live hard. Otherwise, it's not really worth living. So I would like to pass that on to my children as well once they grow up.
Well, it sounds like a good story for them, and we thank you for your call. And I should say, I mean, you're both clearly in terrific shape, but it's not like you're giants or, I mean, Anne, I don't know how tall you are, but you're not very tall.
I'm almost 5'4".
Almost 5'4", okay. and Liv, you've got that kind of very lean expedition look, but walking down the street, it doesn't look like Titans approaching, just very fit women who had what it took to get across.
A lot of passion is really what drives you more than anything, but certainly getting in shape and being physical, but no, we don't, you know, we don't look like the big rocks that people envision.
Right. Joe's calling from Hyde Park, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. Thanks.
I'd like to ask the ladies a question about when they were experiencing difficult times, and when the goal of their journey might have seemed threatened, what thoughts kept you persevering?
Great question. Liv, may I put that to you first?
Yeah, first of all, we lost the hope because we were thinking that we would make it. But I think it's the easiest part is to or the most important part is to take 1 hour at a time and trying to find something positive. Both Anne and I had made this promise to each other that we should have fun, we should stay friends on the other side, and I think that we used humor a lot when the days were quite dark.
So humor, one step at a time. These are messages that we know. And yet, as I read the book, there were moments when you thought you might have to give up, when you thought you might be failing. And what pulled you through those times?
You know, you pull up all sorts of things at different times like that. I think we certainly had thoughts of those children following us and that would buoy us up. Sometimes you just tune into the environment that you were in. And, you know, and again, that's I think that's the stage of life we're in where we can seize the moment of the day, even though it can be quite dark or you're physically exhausted. All of a sudden you'll see, you know, a change in light and the cameras are back out and you're, you know, you're a little bit lighter pulling that sled. So it's amazing over a 97-day span about the ways in which you sort of buoy your spirit up.
Emotions
to the surface.
Ebb and flow. You also carried tiny scraps of paper with tiny messages, or I don't know if it was
Liev
you or
did,
Liev.
Yeah.
Liev, you were carrying from your husband, I guess, who had written. Well, give us some examples. You'd pull one out every day. It sounded like your daily fortune cookie, or maybe something more than that. But what kind of messages? What did they do for you?
Yeah, the plan was that I asked him to write one word, so I could think about that word during the day if I had a difficult day.
Mm-hmm.
But he ended up that he thought I was really difficult, so he sort of had long sentences about some fun things, some good moments, nice moments we had, and that actually ended up that I got a little bit homesick.
Oh, because he painted word pictures of things at home that didn't always help.
Yeah, but I think one moment it was a very good situation when we were close to losing one of our sales, and then he had this note: "No problem is so big that you can't sail away from it." And then I showed that to Anne, and she said, "Well, how can you sail away from our problems when the sailor are trying
no
to
wind.
Sail away from us?"
Right.
And you have to also say that you pulled these little pieces of paper out randomly, so she had no idea that that was the message of the day. And it was amazing how they fit oftentimes.
Yeah. But sometimes it doesn't fit at all because it's, I think, the third day, and he was going to be on the boat meeting us in McMurdo.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "See you in McMurdo."
Well, yes.
97 days to go.
A long time from now. I guess, Anne, as I read this also, it seemed to me there's an element here to the caller's question of being prepared in some degree to redefine your goal. At the very end, you didn't actually make it to the end point that you had envisioned. You made it across the landmass, but you fell some hundreds of kilometers shy of where you really wanted to end up. You write, you say, "I was overwhelmed with disappointment, but afraid to admit defeat. I wanted those last 400 miles. And you really had to, maybe even in conversation with people off Antarctica, kind of readjust and say, yes, this is success."
Yeah, we really had. I had to do that certainly, and part of the reason, oddly enough, was that because I had this injury, I had done so much thinking about those last 400 miles, and how we would do them, where the days would be much longer than we had ever experienced up until then, believe it or not. And
mm-hmm.
I had myself so psyched up that when reality struck, not only was I already a horse going to the barn, but that was an added blow that seemed incredibly overwhelming, that I didn't get my chance to see if I could live through, you know, and push through the pain. And because we had talked so much about, you know, our days of sailing were going to be so long on the
mm-hmm.
Ross Ice Shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And that opportunity felt, you know, pulled from under me.
But they made it, and what a tremendous accomplishment! We've just got a little time. What's your next expedition?
We're going to traverse the Arctic Ocean in 2005.
All right. We wish you luck when you get there. Anne Bancroft and Liev Arneson. Their new book is "No Horizon Is So Far: The Story of the first women in history to cross the Antarctic on foot. Thanks so much to you both for being with us. It's been really interesting.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, finding a unique solution to a political disagreement. This is On Point. Politics may make strange bedfellows, but politics can also strain family relationships. For Massachusetts resident Tiziana Deering, being on opposite sides of the political spectrum has created a decade's worth of tension between her and her husband's mother. But in this radio diary, Deering says a recent revelation brought her and her mother-in-law to a new understanding.
President Bush helped me finally understand my mother-in-law. He seems like an unlikely source for such an in-law epiphany, but I'll take the help from wherever I can get it. My husband and I started dating nearly 12 years ago. I was still in college and still leaning left of left. He was in medical school, so life had yet to curb his bold, conservative upbringing. We fought a lot, for about 4 years, actually. Over time, though, love, experience, and maturity softened us both, moving us to a cozy place near each other on the political spectrum. The same cannot be said for his mother and me. The first time I went home to meet his parents, my husband made me promise not to talk politics. I really tried and did pretty well for the first day. But then there was that lunch at the kitchen table. I had been listening to Rush Limbaugh stories for about 24 hours, and I must have snapped. I said the one word most forbidden in their household, Hillary. Well, what ensued was a lecture on the evils of a power-hungry woman with no respect for other women who care to raise their families. More than a lecture, though, it was a harbinger of years, 11 now to be exact, of unadulterated Clinton-hating. I remember those years as a sort of fog, with images drifting in and out, me trying to hold my peace, my husband's father baiting me with conservative news TV, and my mother-in-law ranting nearly in tongues about the latest Clintonian offense. The years wore on that way, with a particularly uncomfortable streak in 1998. Through all of that, I remained both puzzled and stunned by the ferocity of her dislike. There was no reasoning, no looking at the pros and cons, no separating the policies from the person. It was full-on contempt. Earlier this spring, I was watching President Bush address the nation with my husband. Actually, it was a little more interactive than watching. I heard about 50% of what he said because I drowned out the other 50% yelling at the television. When it was over, I caught my husband giving me an arched eyebrow. "I hate him so much I can't even be reasonable," I breathed. And then it hit me. I get it. In August, we took our 18-month-old daughter home for a visit. Sitting in the family room, my husband said something anti-Bush over the din of Fox News. His mom was quick with a response. It started, "Well, God knows if it had been Bill Clinton." When she was done, she turned to me and began extolling President Bush's virtues as a leader and a man of integrity. I laughed. She stopped abruptly, probably a little offended. "You know how you feel about Bill Clinton?" I asked. She nodded. "That's how I feel about George Bush." She paused for a minute, eyeing me. Then she gave an understanding sort of humph. We both slid onto the floor and quietly joined my daughter in petting the dog.
Tiziana Deering works as a consultant for nonprofit organizations. She lives in Bedford, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.